This is netstat.fm, your weekly podcast about networking, Rust, and everything in between. You are listening to episode 17, recorded on the 21st of November 2025, where Glenn has a conversation with Larry Messenger about the early history of the web and the revival of the Interlisp project.
Welcome to another week of netstat.fm. Today, our guest is Larry Messenger. He's an early internet pioneer and ACM fellow. After attending the Stanford University, he became a principal scientist of Xerox Artificial Intelligence Systems, and he's also the author or co-author of 26 of the Internet Engineering Task Force Requests for Comments or RFCs. In case you worked with any of the HTTP 1.1 or URI RFCs, you might have seen his name. He's a true legend, and I'm very happy that he's today with us. Despite the fact that he's in pension, he is still very active and is working very hard with plenty of other people to bring back the Interlisp system, about which he will tell us all about later as well. So welcome to our Vitubo studio, Larry.
Okay, I'm happy to be here.
Maybe to get started, like, could you maybe tell a bit about, like, how did you get into, like, software and computers? Because, yeah, it was still very early days in those days.
Right. I was an undergraduate at Rice University in Houston, Texas. And I was a math major. I was thinking I was going to be a mathematician. When I was growing up, I wanted to be a scientist. I tried to build a computer when I was in sixth grade. And then, of course, it didn't work. I didn't know that relays, you could make relays out of electromagnets and nails. But that was my early interest. I read some books about artificial intelligence and perceptrons. And I thought that was pretty cool. Well, and it's taken, this is in the 50s. I was born in 1949. Mathematics really attracted me because it was the truth that everything else was statistical and determined by experimentation and revisable, but math was the truth. But I learned some things about computers. I went to a summer science institute by the National Science Foundation in the U.S. Between my junior and senior years of high school. And I learned programming out of 1620 and a UNIVAC 1100 assembly language. And that was a lot of fun, and so I kept that up. Had a part-time job trying to teach computing at a business college. That was hopeless. When I went to Rice, I was thinking that programming was a way to earn money, but that I just kept up with the math, came out to Stanford to be in the math department. This is in 1970, but Vietnam came along, and fear of getting involved in the war led me to apply for this status called conscious objector. So I did that, and we had to do 2 years of alternative service. But my alternative service was to work for the Stanford Medical Center for 2 years on a project called Dendril, which was set up to analyze unknown chemical compounds by their mass spectrograph. That was an interesting project, but it turned out to be a mathematical problem of how to generate all the graphs that satisfy the valence rules, given the molecular formula of how you find graphs without any duplicates. And I needed some group theory and graph theory. And so that was my first real programming job. I was working for Stanford in the joint project by the Stanford Medical Center and the Computer Science Department led by Ed Feigenbaum and Carl Taurasi. Josh Lederberg, he was a Nobel laureate. and Carl Gerasi invented birth control. And Ed Feigenbaum was a leader in computer science. So when that was over, I switched to computers, the degree program in computer science, and stayed on as a grad student until about 1980, but I was really working at Xerox. When I was working on Dindrel, we were using VBN Lisp, and there were a lot of features that I had implemented for Lisp 360. At Stanford that hadn't worked in Lisp, but I thought I was missing that. I learned Algol at Rice. And so combinatorial programming, and I took over the implementation of the structure generator from someone else, and that formed my interest in programming as a kind of domain where artificial intelligence would be useful. And I worked for Warren Teitelman, who was the original founder of the Interlist project. And I'll get into that later when I come back to what I've been doing lately, because I've been working for the last 4 or 5 years on revival of Interlist as a programming, as a historical artifact that runs on modern computers and that you can experience what it was like in the early days of Xerox PARC.
Okay. That's very, very interesting. And I mean, I imagine in those kind of environments, it probably was quite intellectually driving. And if we zoom in on Xerox PARC, like it's a pretty magical place. And I don't really know. I think a lot of people from my generation sometimes wish that we could have worked in a place like that, because a lot of, like really magic happened there, no?
Yes, it was very intellectually stimulating. I remember Feigenbaum got mad at me for saying that I thought the staff at Xerox PARC was more interesting than the faculty at Stanford.
Yeah, I can imagine. Was it actually like a big place? Like how much people work there at those kind of projects?
Maybe there were hundreds, maybe 100, not a lot. And then they did recruit top people. Although, I think my role was more as the technical leader. I inherited from Warren Teitelman and the Interlist project. And it was an infrastructure project to build something that other people could use for research. And so, we had a lot of users around the world of Interlisp, and we worked on the Interlisp-D, the Windows graphical user interface version of it. Anyway, I recommend people go to interlisp.org, to our website, where we've put a lot of material. But along the way, there was a standards effort called Common Lisp and the ANSI committee XVJ13. That I started to work on to come up with a common dialect of Lisp that all the different Lisp implementations could use, because the Department of Defense in the U.S. Was tired of funding people who wrote programs that were incompatible with the systems that other researchers in AI had. And so XVJ13 was founded to come up with a common Lisp language, and I became the kind of representative of the Interlisp side in the Lisp wars. And that was interesting. I wound up chairing the group called the Cleanup Committee. So there were committees on major multilingual text and object-oriented programming and the error system. Some big projects that needed to be handled in the Lisp environment. But then there were a lot of things that were small problems. And I invented the form you had to fill out to get a change to the language. And the methodology of saying you had to fill out this form. But the first part of the form is you describe what the problem was without reference to your solution. And the second part is you describe what your proposed solution is without it, without arguing for it. And then you have to write costs to implementers, costs to users, et cetera, before you got into testimonials and history of the feature or whatever. And that was very successful in getting people who were arguing about, get them to agree that the form was filled out. If they could agree on the form, then you could say, well, there are some places where you trade off the cost to implementers and the cost to users, and you have to make a choice. At least the nature of the choice and why people were making it was clear. Anyway, as I had worked on Lisp and the AI winter came along and the market for Lisp and Lisp machines and other things kind of died, and I had to switch at Xerox because I didn't go with the Lisp spin out. I had to switch to something else. So at the time, Xerox was trying to reinvent itself as the document company as opposed to the copier company. And so we worked on some document servers, as in this whole client-server architecture for accessing data from disparate systems. And we had three or four different kinds of systems that were in use at Park after the denouement of the Lisp machines. And they all had different file formats. And so what we defined was a document server was different from a file server in that the document in text and in PDF and in Word were all the same document, just in different formats, with some amount of the difference between the identity of the document and then the representation of the document. And this notion of separating the two became an essential part of HTTP, that you would request something, would hand the server your request, and the server would give you a representation of the state of that resource. You never transferred resources over the network. You only transferred representations.
You mean like metadata? Kind of like how you would use like a head request to just get some head spec to get information about the resource?
Well, you would say the client would present to the server a request. Give me the right resource with this path and accept, and these accept headers about what representations you could deal with. And then the server would return you some representation. You ask for an image and you gave it text. So there was an interim project at the time at Park called System 33. And System 33 was an essential part of what we were trying to bring into content negotiation. I thought was the underpinnings of the HTTP distinction between resources and representations. Roy Fielding wrote this as part of his thesis, a model called REST, which was a good more theoretical approach to what we were trying to do with files and file formats.
This was already like a network server, right?
Yes. System 33 was a network server, and it shared the protocol from... It had a kind of protocol similar to Gopher. Gopher was the inspiration for HTTP 0.9.
And by the way, like, it's actually despite how of a fundamental of a protocol it is, like, it's the first time somebody brings Gopher up on this podcast. Like, maybe for the especially younger audience, could you maybe quickly explain a bit, like, what Gopher was and how it was working?
Well, Gopher was an outgrowth of the network instantiation of the common notion of a menu system, where the information resource had a bunch of menus, A, B, C, D, E, 10, 15, and you would select them and you would select what you were looking for, and maybe you could type in a query, and you would get back text or a PDF. Actually, this predated PDF. So it was a menu-based system, which you could turn into hypertext by adding all the stuff in between the links. So Gopher was a system for doing network access to information and for resources, but only through menus. And the invention of hypertext, which had been gone on independently, Tim brought that hypertext into Gopher. And I remember when I visited CERN sometime in, the early 80s, early 90s. No, I don't remember. They had a chart of the number of sites that were Gopher versus WWW. And they were working on increasing the acceptance of Gopher and of the Gopher community to the web. And what was critical at the time was that CERN decided to make the web open source while Gopher was caught up in a plan by the University of Minnesota to start charging license fees for using Gopher. And that difference was instrumental in Gopher, that and several other things. So we worked hard on getting a Gopher URI scheme that could encapsulate all of the kinds of different ways you could request things that were Gopher, so that the web could include everything that the Gopher could do. And so that was important.
And did those URIs differ a lot with what we now know in HTTP?
Well, HTTP 0.9 was very much like Gopher. You open up a connection, you send a request, you get back a document, you close the connection. And the performance wasn't really important because this was a human, the number of requests you would get would be one per document. So you would retrieve the document and close the connection. You didn't want fast start or cache connections or anything else because there was no embedded objects. I think HTTP 0.9 open a connection, send the request, receive the results, and close it. That happened. How often would that happen? Once a few minutes.
Yeah, correct. And I even remember with HTTP 0.9 is that, like, there were a lot of headers not even there yet, like, including, I think, content length. Sometimes you would just send a payload, and then because you close the connection anyway, like, you wouldn't even send the content length because you would know when the connection is closed, that's when my payload ends.
That was important for generating services that are URLs. The first map server was done by Steve Putz. The map server for the web. And that had the feature, this was before we had forums, that you would just click on the links to, as your user interface, to modify what the map server was showing. That was an early paper in the web conference. To show that you could build a service with only using hypertext links without any other way to input data.
And that would mean that each time you want to, like, navigate in the map, it would need to fetch, make a new connection, fetch that part of the map and serve it to you.
Yes, right. Well, the only data it had was the coastline data from the internet resource of all the coastlines of the world. So that was the only navigation you did.
But I imagine it's still very exciting if you were seeing it at the time.
Right, yes.
And then to go back a bit to the fact you were trying to come up with, like, a URI scheme for, like, Gopher and connecting it to HTTP. But does that mean that at that point we already had things like hostname and path and those kind of things?
No, the hostname was added later. Hostname came from the need of server vendors, service providers, to have multiple hostnames all served by one computer.
Right. Yeah, because I imagine in the past it was just a server, is one server, really. So you really identified already because you connect to it over TCP with the correct IP address. So I suppose you already know that's the server I'm connecting to, and at that point you can only just use the pod, I guess.
Right, yeah.
And query parameters, was that a thing or also not yet?
I forget when query parameters came in. Might have been part of the original design. The query parameters came in with forms.
All right. Makes sense.
HTTP/09 and the early web didn't have forms. And didn't have embedded objects. At the time, I imagine people would use a format like DBF, where a compound document format, that's what it was. Apple had one, and I think they called it Binto.
Which means that it sends you this kind of document, and you fill it in, and then you like upload it again? Is that what you're talking about? Or
no, I mean, for one of the differences between HTTP and Gopher was that HTTP was optimized for what we had to add when we went from HTTP 1.0 to HTTP 1.1 was the performance enhancement of sharing a connection for multiple requests, pipelining, because you didn't want the TCP slow start to dominate your performance. Anyway, getting ahead of myself. So I got into the web standards world because working on System 33, I was interested in finding other research ideas for how to create interoperability between workstations with different kinds of capabilities for displaying files in different formats. And the web was interesting enough. I started going to the organizational meetings around HTTP, around the web, and I invited Tim Berners-Lee to come visit a park, and he spent a couple of months there. And at the time, Hypertext, Park had an active program in Hypertext called Note Cards. Note Cards is now part of the Interlisp revival. One of the original developers of Note Cards, Frank Alas, has been part of our Interlisp project. And they were looking for someone to chair the working groups, originally the URI working group, and then later on the HTTP working group. And I had experience with standards. And a standard for a language is kind of like a standard for a protocol. And they're both languages for expressing interfaces between different objects. So when I talk about protocol, I want to include the language Lisp for the language Algol or the language Fortran or language Rust as just more kinds of interfaces. And the standard for an interface, if you want to make a change to it, there are really three things that surround the language that people speak. There's a specification. There's a written description of what the language is. There are implementations, things that take one or two or three, whatever it is that you're talking about. Each of them, they're implementations of producers and consumers of the interface for a bilateral interface. And then there are test suites that test whether or not the implementation matches the specification. And in the end, what you care about is changing the language itself, but you can't really do that. You have to either change the specification, the implementations, or the test suites to surround the language and change it along the way. And language specifications are much more complicated than implementation specifications. Although some languages are specified by a virtual implementation. So you take Java, and Java is specified by the documentation for its virtual machine, at least some parts of it. So that's interesting. I think underlying this is some theory of documents and an algebra of describing how these things interact. And I spent some time on the W3C technical architecture group, and writing up, but I didn't really finish.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it is very abstract, and I imagine you. Yeah, it's easy to lose your mind on.
Well, so around the time of the pandemic, I was looking for some project. I retired from Xerox kind of on disability. I had Parkinson's and had had it for a large number of years. I was first diagnosed in, 2004. After several years of not coping all that well, I had this procedure they call deep brain stimulation, where they insert some electrodes in your brain and to an embedded controller in my chest, which sends signals that interfere with the Parkinson's tremors and the basal ganglia in some way that I don't really understand. But it gave me a new ability to focus. I was looking for some project to take over my desire to contribute. My former colleagues from Xerox, two of them, Ron Kaplan and Nick Briggs, were working on getting Interlist to run again on modern hardware and modern OSs. That was my third attempt at a retirement project. I thought that I would do something that would help other Parkinson's patients, but I didn't make a lot of progress on that. And then when COVID came along, I thought maybe I could build a website to help people learn how to do things online, because I didn't think the pandemic would ever be over. But people discovered that on their own in a variety of ways. And so revival of Interlist became my main project. And now we've been doing it for 5 years. There's about maybe 15 contributors to the open source project. Yeah, it's on interlist.org. You go to http://interlist.org, and that should give you access to everything. There's a new primer that we're funding some students at University of Alberta to help out. We accept donations, of course.
Very cool. I mean, it even seems to include note cards and everything.
Yeah, it has note cards, has rooms, has loops. We have a lot of graphics packages. We have people who are using Medley Interlist to enter into the game jam. Can you build a new game based on Interlist? I mean, retro-looking graphics.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of it. Like, originally, I come from the game industry, and yeah, it's very nice to work on older systems. They are a lot more easier to grasp, and especially also the hardware. Like, if you want to understand something like one of the older processors, like the ones in a Game Boy or like even older ones, I mean, they're relatively easy to understand. But if you compare it to like a modern CPU or something, it's an entire, I don't know, like a very, very big book or several books just to encompass the instructions, let alone all the details. So, simpler times is nice to develop for.
Well, the implementation was based on the original implementation in Xerox PARC for maybe four different languages we supported. And depending on the group, there was the Lisp group, there was the Smalltalk group, there was a Cedar group, Mesa, and there was a lot of friendly competition. That you see something in one of the other systems that you wanted it in yours, and a lot of cross-fertilization of ideas.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at these systems like Smalltalk and Interlisp, I always feel there is like something lost there. Now we didn't like recover again, like capabilities that they had that we are still missing today in like what you would call modern languages.
Yes. Well, the ability mainly, I think, in Lisp is to, at an error, rewind the stack and change the code and keep on running. Compile, load, execute. To speed up the turnaround, time to fix a bug and keep on going.
So I guess the first part of the project was to get it working on modern systems. Is there still like a big road ahead of you?
Well, no, you know, the Interlist project was originally at Xerox and was spun out into a separate company called Invos. And then that became, that closed down, and there was another company started by John Sabalski called Venue, and he had the rights to create derivative works. And, he passed away. And then the system was kind of in limbo for a decade or two, and until the heir of the IPR rights to create derivative works and to distribute them. He gave to us. That's why we were able to make it open source. But that system included, it had already been ported to some workstations. And then we got it to run on a Mac. And so it was already kind of halfway, or more than halfway ported. It was written in Kernighan and Plauger C. So there's a virtual instruction set. And then the compile your Lisp, but something I like with Emacs Lisp these days, which came after Medley, Interlisp, because then you compile the bytecodes. The bytecodes are an abstract Lisp instruction set. And so, originally it was designed for very compact programs when memory was rare and a lot more expensive than CPU. But it has the advantage of also portability because most of the system is written in Lisp and only the very low level, the lowest level of abstraction is implemented in C by interpreting the bytecoded instruction set.
That's nice. I mean, I can understand why that makes your life a lot easier because that's the only part you would have to port, I imagine.
Yeah, well, in the end, it turns out some things are, we don't want to rely on our common Lisp implementation because it's so lacking. And so we go out to the host operating system to do some operations like open up a web page or convert a file from PostScript to PDF. So some of these things still require that. All of the people on the project are volunteers. So, and most people don't work full time when they're retired.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a passion, I suppose you find time for it. But at the same time, I guess life also moves on.
Right. Well, we meet twice a week. Talk about it.
Yeah, that's quite a lot.
Well, not everyone who contributes, yes, it comes to the meetings. And mainly old-timers and a few students. We have a few people who are in between jobs or otherwise looking for some way to amuse themselves. What else can I tell you?
You can tell me a lot. For example, you can tell me how in 1998... you invented the Hypertext Coffee Pot Control Protocol, or HTCPCP.
There's a tradition in the IETF of April 1st RFCs. The IETF produces a series of documents called RFCs, which originally stood for Requests for Comments. But it was really kind of late in the process to be asking just for comments. Requests for errata, probably. But not every RFC is a standard, and the RFCs have RFC numbers. The goal is the RFCs never change. If you want to make a change, you need to the language, you need to change, create a new version of the specification, or at least say updates. So one RFC can either obsolete or update another RFC. But not all RFCs are standards. And to make this point, the I think, introduced the notion of an April 1st RRC, which you can tell by the date of the RRC is always the April 1st of the year. And it's the only ones that have the day of the month in them explicitly. So an April RRC is not an April 1st RRC. So there's a famous, there's some famous RFCs. There's the TCP over carrier pigeon, over avian carriers, where they describe how they, there had been a large series of documents about how to do TCP over different transmission media mechanisms. So HTTP over cable television and TCP over, I said HTTP, but I meant TCP. TCP over modems and different kinds of ways of carrying TCP over transports. And avian carriers was how to use carrier pigeons to do TCP between different, using birds.
And did they also try it, or was it just purely theoretical?
No, some people did this. They reported on their success at doing TCP over carrier pigeons. And but my favorite line in the RFC is the bandwidth is proportional to the leg length, the width of the band around the carrier pigeons.
Yeah.
It's proportional.
That's a cult. Yeah, I just wonder, like, is it just like they, is it then something that you just think like, okay, this year I want to be the one writing a 1st of April joke, or do they come to someone in the community and say like, maybe this year you can write one? I know, how does that come?
I'm not entirely sure, but I believe the RFC editor, originally it was John Postel, was the RFC editor and the keeper of the April 1st queue. But now I'm not sure. I think it's still the RFC editor. Or in the editor's office or something. But at the time, there were a lot of proposals to use HTTP as a substrate for implementing something that wasn't web access. So the Internet Printing Protocol, IPP, wanted to use HTTP, and I was on this committee, and I thought, why do they want to use HTTP? And I never got a good answer. You know, it wasn't necessarily that it was adapted for it. It was HTTP is everywhere, so it must be good. And it seemed to me. So I wrote a little document trying to explain HTCPCB. It's somewhere on my website. My idea is that the April 1st RFCs serve as a instructive way of reductio ad absurdum. You take something and you reduce it to its essential into some contradiction or bad design or something. So my idea with HTTPCP was taking all the ways that you could extend HTTP to do something and misusing them. So I wanted a new MIME type and a new method, the brew method, which is equivalent to POST. There had been a long debate in the IPP group over whether or not to introduce a new method. And there are no guidelines for any of these extension mechanisms.
And that means you can never cache your brew, as it's similar to POST, you see.
Yes. And the new URI scheme using Unicode, hex encoded, UTF-8 encoded Unicode, and for coffee. Spelled in different languages with an errata because I got the Japanese wrong.
Fantastic. I mean, not fantastic or wrong, but it's very cool that you still make an errata for it.
And the error codes, is there are a lot of debates over whether or not what kind of error code you should use. If you wanted to be more fine-grained than a 401 or 402 or 404, and there's no rationale given for when to allocate a new error code. So I invented 418, I'm a teapot. Because, of course, it makes no sense to have HTTP request to a coffee pot for it to return that it's not really a coffee pot.
And yet now this code lives in pretty much every HTTP implementation out there.
Right. Yeah, well, people got by the, I'm a little teapot, short and spout. Tip me over and pour me out. There's several other things in there about firewalls and a bad security considerations section.
But then later, you also co-authored an RFC around like the mail to URL scheme. But that's just about the URL, right? That's not to do with HTTP. Yeah.
No, it's just about the URL. There's an internet draft that is not an RFC, but that I like, and every once in a while I'm tempted to bring it forward, but haven't found anyone who would want to co-sponsor it. But it's about two URI schemes called DURI and TDB. We're using dates, and there's a problem that whenever you give a reference to the URI or URL, it's ambiguous about what you're really trying to refer to. And you say, this URL is in English. He's talking about just the resource that you're pointing to, the resource with all of its embedded objects, resource in the whole website, or the resource that is as it existed a minute ago, right now, at this instant, or the resource over time. And the TDB URL was supposed to give you a way of saying that you can have a URL for anything. How many URLs are there? How many resources are there? Well, there's infinitely many. Are they countably many or infinitely many? Because countably is less. There are numbers that are not countable. Anyway, TDB stands for thing described by with a date. And you say, well, I mean the thing as of that date. No reference to the future stream of possible values. If you really want to come up with a formal definition, a theoretical definition of what a URI is that it represents, that's a hard road for philosophers.
Yeah, I mean, I feel it has such an ambiguous use because I cannot even count how many, at least by now, how many protocols like use the URI and where they are similar, where they are not. And then, I mean, including also some RFCs of yours, because you also are, I think, the co-author of the URL scheme to represent like data. I think basically for encoded. And even that is like all the URL, but like that looks nowhere near what most people would think of, is a URL.
Yeah, the data URL reminded me of when I was learning assembly language of the UNIVAC 1100 back in my high school days. They had the thing called a median address. You'd have an address, which wasn't really an address. It was just the number itself.
Would it be like just a random number, sequential number, or more like a hash?
So there was a flag in the word. So you'd pull up a word. And you say, I want to read the word. You have something that takes a pointer, but you don't want to give it a pointer to somewhere you store the data. You just want to give it the data itself. There were indirect addresses, which were, you would go and open the thing and it would say, I'm an indirect, and then I'm really over there instead. And that's like with HTTP, and you get a moved, you say where it is, and it follows the link. But we didn't have immediate addresses, and so that seemed to solve some problems for people. The data URL has really grown in useful now that they've figured out that the security context is the same as the parent that gave you the URL in the first place.
I mean, yeah. I'm not sure how much use there is today, but the place where I see it mostly is when people use it for like embedding images and stuff.
Right. Yeah, that needed more work. And they have the only RFC that has a picture of the author, and the data URL RFC is an example, which is a very low resolution image of me when my beard was dark instead of white.
Look at that. A little, you know, I never, like, even considered, like, opening the, or, like, decoding the, or, like, I don't know, embedding it in HTML and checking what's underneath the data.
Oh, you have to have fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we do it, right? I mean, and that's all, I mean, yeah, I mean, how could you keep learning on something and working your craft and keep exploring it if it's not because you enjoy it? Like, you just wouldn't, and neither would you keep exploring and trying to bend your mind because, I mean, you were probably, like, yeah, you tell me, like, with how I sometimes experience it, it's like, and those are also often my more happier moments is when I try to figure something out and I feel like my brain is really melting. And it can sometimes just take hours or days or weeks. And you try to iterate. And eventually you come up with solutions. And sometimes in steps, sometimes immediately, I don't know. And it's those things, those epiphanies, like you feel like, okay, well, like, I don't know, everything becomes so clear. And I guess it's those kind of like sensations that you keep trying to rush, I guess, I don't know.
Like, you reach a moment.
Yeah, and so of course, sometimes it's a one moment, sometimes it's just, I don't know, like, more like a stretch or a series of moments, but yeah, that kind of feeling. And how come these things, like, okay, for example, if we take, for example, something like a data URL scheme, what was a specific need or purpose that, or was it just because for fun? Or was there also, like, an actual, like, yeah, we are actually having a problem here, and this was our way to solve it.
Yeah, I wish I could remember, but I don't. And it was someone who had a problem that this came to mind as a possible solution.
And then, for example, if we look at something like forum-based file upload in HTML, because as far as I know, you also worked on that, right?
Yes. That was a problem that someone at Xerox had. And they wanted to upload a file to a web server that was a printer. And they didn't have a way of doing that. And it seemed to me that we could do better than just adding an upload command. There was a lot of problems with form submission. And forms didn't have a way of specifying the server couldn't tell the client what fields it wanted or what MIME type it wanted them in, or the content negotiation was only one way, and there was no way to label the content that you got back as to where the data was. So I was trying to generalize the solution. I think the modern HTML includes different mechanisms for uploading files, though, that were based more in the implementation. The politics of the web standards was, as most politics are, was really kind of ugly.
And that's mostly because of the commercial partners or also among, like, researchers?
No, it was mainly the what working group. Depending on who you talk to, they wanted control, or they were trying to manage their implementations without the interference. No, there's a, in the IETF, there's no membership. There's no in-group, the decision mechanism is rough consensus, which means that no one person can or company can hold you back from doing something. But sometimes that's rougher than others. And there is a philosophical difference about how the specification should or shouldn't accommodate describing what should happen in a situation where other implementations would say it's an error. So the URI spec is still under some contention. There's a what working group version of the URL spec, and there's an IETF version of the URI spec. And this difference in name, talking about the same thing with two different names and two different specifications, is frustrating to a lot of people.
I mean, I find it very confusing, to be honest. Like,
yeah.
Because there are, I mean, so also the context is that I also am the developer and maintainer of like a network, like framework or set of libraries. And so then at times I'm trying to maybe, I don't know, find common abstraction points between all these different URLs or URIs or this or that. And I don't know, there are so many little details. And but yeah, as you say, even just the name. And actually, I think even if I recall correctly, I think you have an RFC where you even explain a bit around like URI, URL, URN even, I think. And yeah, I don't know, like, but also it's just surprising how much stuff uses a URL. And they do often all look nowadays where they have like a scheme and a host name and a path and a query. Like, there are plenty of those, but yeah, that's not all it is, I guess.
I don't know what to do about the situation. I was hoping that when the original disputants retired or went on to another job, maybe some more rational people could come in and satisfy this conundrum. But I'm not sure. I don't think I have much to contribute to it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, too bad. Because you were a very, I mean, you were there, you know. I guess my concern a bit, like, if we wait 10, 20 years more, I don't know, you know, like how in the UK, I mean, when the people found the ruins of the Romans and they didn't even know what it was about, they thought it was like made by giants. And I have a feeling we also want to look at these RFCs or like at these old mailing forms and, or mailing groups, and I have no idea what it was about. And then, yeah, a lot of context would be lost.
Well, my consolation is that the stuff we have works reasonably well. So maybe the differences don't matter.
Yeah, I guess so.
if it was really a serious problem, then people would jump in to solve it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they do work very well. I suppose the issue is basically that, yeah, I guess a URI can just be many things. Maybe it was a bit silly to call them all like a URI or a URL or, I don't know, because they can look so different.
We invented the name change from URL to URI with the idea of carving off the URNs. And I think that they didn't really solve any problem for anyone.
No, not particularly.
That was something I held up until I gave in.
And then at some point, I think you also worked on RFC, which is like RFC 2732, or I don't know how you pronounce these things, 2732. Where it's about like formatting of literal IPv6 addresses in URLs. Like, yeah. I wonder what is the use there? Like, I mean, because, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Like, you wouldn't ever remember those kind of addresses, right? They're especially IPv6. Yeah. An IPv4 address I can sometimes remember, but an IPv6 I never can remember.
That was forced on us by the IPv6 committee. Yeah, it didn't really fit into the syntax, and they should have fixed it before. But it's a little bit like the internationalization of domain names. And there's a DNS to ASCII transformation in the DNS protocols that is not the same as the way that you write a DNS name, a Unicode DNS name in a URL. And I remember going to the internationalization of domain names committee and asking them to please add to their scope the internationalization of URLs. And they said, no, it was scope creep. They wouldn't take on the problem.
Is that something that you would think is like a good idea? That you internationalize like URLs? Because it seems to me like it would be, I don't know. I mean, like origin, I mean, for example, if I look at it, the problem of things like phishing or scams, I would feel like once you can have like full Unicode URLs, like you could have so much potential to confuse people of going to some wrong website.
It's absolutely all there. There's a service provider that will sell you a .redheart domain. So if you want to be Larry dot and then a red heart emoji, so you can get emoji domain names. And many web clients will be able to access them.
Seems a bit, unnecessary. I don't know.
Well, you know, people adapt technology to their own uses. And I worked on that this problem for a while before I gave up on how to tell whether or not if you give a URL, how many people will be in your target audience will be able to take that URL and apply it and get the right answer. And then if you go through a protocol that goes to a person reading the URL on the side of a bus, and then being able to type it in and get the right resource, you can say, well, how many people can read that? And if you can emit the URL and it doesn't pass through the human reading and transcribing and using, then it's not a very good URL, so don't make those up. Don't pass them around if they're not. And then it's not up to the protocol to decide in advance which things will or won't work. You know, so my email address is lmm@acn.org. Every once in a while I get people who treat the initial L as a capital I.
Yeah, and that's like still a simple example. So,
yeah.
Once you have Unicode, that's...
They're just more examples of ambiguities like that.
Yeah. Well, okay. And then I feel like definitely a big one we also worked on besides URIs and a lot around data and Interlisp is also the fact that you contributed to the HTTP 1.1 spec. I mean, the original one.
Yes.
Which was quite, I don't know. That definitely was a turning point, I feel, of HTTP, where it went from its origins to, I feel it's kind of like the portal between the origins and where we are now heading with HTTP, well, HTTP 2 and then later HTTP 3. Like, it definitely, I feel like a lot of that started here, like where they had the concepts they want to solve, but I guess maybe not at the time having the tools to do so.
We were trying not to be inventive as much more as selection. That there was a problem. Different people had come up with different solutions. And they all couldn't coexist. Had to choose. And we were not trying to avoid trying to invent new things.
So all these, they were like mostly out there in the wild, you see? Like all those different headers and concepts, but maybe like in incompatible ways.
Yeah. Yeah, the HTTP/1 spec was not intended to be a reinvention. Just the ambiguities that people felt. So current implementations were really important. I never felt like we could make the kind of changes. Remember when the HTTP BIS came up under Mark Nottingham, I went and gave a talk at their working group meeting saying, you know, we couldn't change this. We couldn't change the referrer field to fix the misspelling. We couldn't make that change.
Yeah. it's still in there. Well, it's kind of weird, right? Because you could call the solution where you say like, okay, you have like a long period, like even if it's 20 years where you use both, like you accept both headers, like you have like a referrer and the correct spelling. And then I imagine it would probably be safe after 3 decades to phase out the, I don't know, like the original one, but never happened.
The only time the change was mandated was the addition of the host header. That was the only thing that wasn't optional.
But like among, right, for example, some things in even in those visual specs, I never see in the wild. For example, the trace header, like the trace method, like I never see it being used.
Yeah.
But then again, I feel in general, people don't really use methods a lot. Like that's kind of like for example, like one thing, the one reason I started with this podcast was because I want to educate people around network protocols. And so, for example, a common thing, and HTTP is an example of that, because I feel most developers don't even know, even if we just talk about HTTP 1.1, like how it works or what it has, like all these methods, all these different status codes, because like, I mean, if you, like some protocols built on top of HTTP are just always returning 200 OKs, even if it's like an error, and they will put the error in the payload or something or whatever, which is very confusing, yeah. Especially for proxies. And then, or like, let's say I visit a website, and so for example, I'm from Belgium, so we speak like 3 languages here, at least the official one, but of course there are plenty other ones. So there are also people living here which might speak a language which is not official. And yet, because a lot of servers do it like GeoIP based, they will like serve you, I don't know, French, because maybe your IP address looks like it's in Brussels or in the right. French side of Belgium. And that's a very frustrating experience, because like you might not even find where to switch the language, because yeah, maybe it's not a language you're familiar with, and so you're trying to look around, like where can I switch the language? And so, yeah, I don't know. Like, I find it a shame, because like we keep working on new protocols, but I feel like we are not even properly using the original ones yet. I mean, not original, but still, like these are. I mean, for example, HTTP 1.1 is from 1999, so I would have hoped that there is plenty of time to learn about it by now, how like it works, all these different status codes and methods and headers.
I go back to the tripod implementations, specifications, and test suites. What working group has really taken on the test suites define what the language is. And the specification is also ran.
Yeah, I mean, I feel the specification is fine, the language is fine, the test suite is fine. It's more like people don't seem to be aware of it.
Right, yeah, well, that's down to the implementation. It seemed to me that there was a difference between... The difference also has to do with how many implementations are there. The emitters of HTTP, HTML, there are millions.
Yeah, for sure.
And while HTML interpreters is really a decreasing number of them, but with Edge turning into Chrome, and we're left with Safari and Chrome.
Well, you still have Firefox, of course.
And Firefox.
And then, like, you have, like what is it called, Ladybird? Is that the new one on the block?
Yeah, but, always a handful.
Yeah, for sure. Well, but, I mean, yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's not an easy one, of course, to do, but but you do want it, of course. But yeah, there's so many protocols to be implemented, and especially they keep pushing out new standards, because then you're not only talking about network protocols, but you're also talking about web APIs and this and right. that. And like, I feel like every year we have maybe 10 or 20 more of these. So it starts to add up, which sometimes I do feel like,
Yeah.
Maybe we should just pause a bit. I'm not sure we need so many of them.
Well, everyone, with standards, there's a value in having things work the same. And there's a value in having them work the same as long as it's my way.
Yeah, exactly. So I get it. Also, it also helps if you're the first one, I guess, to do it, because you get to define your way, I guess.
Right.
If you look back at on all this and how HTTP is used now and how UDIs are used, how you feel about it.
I thought I did some good work, and but I got away from my being able to be hands on. And so I'm happy to be back in the world of Lisp and an implementation where I'm the technical lead, kind of, and I can hack away.
It's amazing. And nowadays, how do you develop? What kind of system do you develop on? What kind of editor? What kind of, terminal, those kind of things?
The Interlisp was an operating system.
And that was what you developed on?
And you develop in the Interlisp environment using Lisp. I assume the emulator is pretty much done. Have a good implementation. It uses X or SCF for display. And you get a window and it's black and white and pixelated. And you develop in the whole thing. The nice thing is that it runs 1,000 times faster than it did 20 years ago.
In a way it's nice, but also I can imagine it can also cause issues.
It had a way of slowing down. Some of the graphics demos had to be slowed down.
I read that Interlisp was using another kind of encoding, which was from Xerox, and now you switch it to Unicode. What was the original then?
It's called the Xerox Character Code Standard. It was one of the original contributors to the Unicode. The Unicode was based on XCCS and some other work from Apple, pretty much. ISO 646. Joe Becker did the original Xerox Japanese typing system. And he did his prototype work in Lisp. And we switched to Unicode as an external format, but inside, the strings are all represented in strings of 16-bit characters.
That's kind of like UTF-16 then.
Well, except with different character codes. Mm. So we're working on revising our fonts. Use more modern fonts. Unicode support is a big deal. Better fonts is a big deal. We're working on reducing the overhead of getting into it. So if you go to online.interlisp.org, you get you can log in over the web. It opens up a VNC connection to a Docker container. It runs Interlisp in sandbox for you, and if you log in and give us a username and password, we'll keep your data for at least 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like I can even run as a guest just to try it out.
Yeah, you want to log in the guest and you don't get a persistent file system.
That's very cool. I feel like I could spend some months in here locked up in this virtual environment.
Well, we have full implementation of PUP and XNS prior to the TCP introduction, because the Xerox protocols were far more advanced than the internet protocols.
But you mentioned PUP. I mean, I only know that in the context of mail protocols. That's what you're talking about?
No, PUP was a whole file access, complete protocol stack, printing, filing, inter-device communication, and a remote eval server. The loops system for the Lisp object-oriented programming system had a game that they were calling Trucken. And there's a way that you can run Trucken on multiple D machines. This is in the early 80s. And this sequence packet protocol and courier remote procedure call all in full implementations. So I'd like to put together a demo using older protocols of networking in the Lisp world.
And do you think there would be benefit or use of porting some of these to implementations in modern languages and make use of it? Like, do you think it unlocks potential that we wouldn't have now? And are these kind of things that you would build on top of TCP or where would they be?
I'm thinking more of historical reenactment. If you do a historical reenactment of a famous battle, and more for the understanding of how the internet really began. That's what we're doing with a lot of our demos. We're trying to get into the computer museum support business.
Is that the one in the Bay Area, or which one was it?
Well, we have an exhibit of Medley running at the Interim Computer Museum, which is a follow-on from Paul Allen's Living Computer Museum, which closed. And what I'm hoping is that we can make some demos where you click on the URL and it brings you into running Medley online with the demo loaded and let you explore from there. It's a kind of demo mode. That's one thing that our project, the Interlist project, Medley Interlist project is working on, is demo mode.
I just looked it up, so seems I wasn't too far off the ball. Like because you said PUP, right? And I was thinking it was around mailing, but that's exactly what it's about, no? Like that effect where it's basically the protocol of one of the protocols used to between mail clients and servers, no?
It's certainly this one application, for sure.
But you're saying there's a lot more of it. I know there's fax and stuff and those kind of things. Is that what you're referring to?
There's PUP file server access. So we had a file server called the Interim File Server, IFS. And there were a bunch of file servers. The Computer History Museum has the backups from PARC. Have a lot of systems. They were given as a gift from Xerox.
Very nice.
And I'd like to revive some of those systems because there were early systems for collaborative work. The Collab had a lab where people could share screens and communicate and work independently. Decades before Google Docs. I didn't have a lot of aspiration of this stuff being useful as is. But as a source of ideas, the things that have already been explored as prior art for patents, as a way of giving people another perspective on how things don't have to be necessarily the same.
True. And is there a set of, I don't know, criteria or items that you would say, like,
if we achieve this and this and this with the Interlisp revival project, then I would call success? Or is it just for the, you all have fun, you keep doing what you can do, and that's it?
My goal is to reach escape velocity, I tell people. Escape velocity is the system can be maintained without any of the original developers. So, and there's enough people working on it, because we didn't start with a clean release. We started with the 1990s version of Interlisp, where they had, heard John Sapowski had increased the address space by a factor of 16, 4 bits. It was originally a 24-bit address space. Now it's a 28-bit address space. And several other improvements, including the Common Lisp standard implementation, which had changed. And so we have some major problems. You know, we have a GitHub, it's all on GitHub, under the Interlisp group. You look at the half a dozen repos. So I'm trying to run the project as if it was IETF. Decisions by rough consensus. And everything open. So the meeting notes, groups, are all available for anyone who wants to see. I'm hoping the website is a good introduction. I recommend people especially look at the bibliography, which is new. We have a collection of papers and reports about Interlisp and also about systems built in it, if they discuss Interlisp.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of reading material on there. You could spend an eternity reading all that.
Well, tell your friends.
We can all take a part and we can split the work.
Well, you know, things that you find interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, personally, I always found these languages very interesting. I don't think I've done too much with Lisp itself, but I've done a lot of work around the Scheme, which is, as far as I know, derived from Lisp.
It's derived from, but it's we turned Interlisp into a system implementation language. So, you know, you can read and write packets.
Mm.
If it was the whole operating system had to be done in Lisp.
Well, that's super powerful, because, yeah, I mean, that means you can basically modify on the fly everything.
Yes.
But at the same time, I have a hard time envisioning that you could ever do that, like if you want to have a complete system, it's not intuitive to me that you could ever do that very efficient.
Well, you know, I have a new way of thinking about efficiency, which is not in terms of percentages, but rather in terms of years of Moore's Law.
Hmm.
And an efficient language is one, these days, is one where computation can be done in parallel.
Yeah, that's true. If I was still like younger and before I had a family and a couple of kids, I would have probably spent way too much of my time reading quite a lot of this. It's very nice.
Right. We're taking a different approach to software preservation. We're not trying to preserve. If you want an emulator of exactly what a D machine, Xerox Lisp machines, felt like, you could get one of those. We have them point out how to do that. But we're really trying to bring it to the point where it's usable for people who want to build something quickly.
Mm. Yeah, the way I like to contribute also to preservation is often to I don't know, re-implement old networking protocols and making sure people can keep connecting to them. I mean, we talked about Gopher, for example, in the past, in the start of the conversation, and I mean, it's still being used. Like, there are still plenty of Gopher servers, and
like people sharing and interacting with each other via GoFund.
Yeah.
And I mean, I find it very exciting to implement these kind of protocols and make a client for it and have a server for it and be part of the network. And yeah, I mean, it would be same even for this, right? Like, one aspect is the Intellis, but you also have many, like, protocols there. Some are unique to Xerox, but like it could also be cool for others to, I don't know, connect from the outside over those protocols to Intellis systems.
The focus that we wanted to have was on connecting Intellis to STAR and the Gateway Access Protocol and the PDB10 Lisp. There was some early work that I'd like to be able to demo. And then of remote eval and email, there was talk about an ARPANET reenactment of the, and that would be possible. What we're trying to do is encapsulate the XNS and PUP protocol packets inside. Well, currently inside HTTP, I'm sorry, inside TCP, there is one fellow who built an emulator he called Dodo for a D machine with flightless bird that is now extinct. But the Dodo network encapsulates XNS inside TCP. But as a way of demonstrating or letting people play with these older protocols, to see what it was like. So we were currently working with Professor Eric Kaltman at the University of Alberta. He has a group called Software History and Future Technology. And his broader research is around using emulations for software preservation. And it seemed like he was a good collaborator. And they have a lot of students who are in the library school or the digital humanities group that have been helping us with the primer and the bibliography and giving some talks about the project.
Very good. That's good. It's good to have those kind of collaborators.
Yeah. I think we're not going to reach the escape velocity unless we have some younger participants.
Yeah, and I guess where to find them better than universities and students that are probably just as passionate and might, I mean, probably like me, where we often feel like we missed the boat there or where we wanted to be there, and I guess this is kind of like their moment to, or their chance to, I don't know, live a bit in that time. Like, be it via the preservation and helping to maintain it and evolve it. I guess it's as close as we can get to it, being born way too late.
Well, you know, the bibliography work really turned into its own project. I think we could extract that out of the Intellis package, out of our website, and turn it into a general Hugo theme or some other kind of extension. So if someone wants to build using Zotero, the citation database open source project, using that to gather the bibliography out of the metadata and then return that into static HTML pages.
Yeah, I mean, those kind of websites are always also very interesting. Like, and
yeah,
there are surprisingly a lot of them around all kind of topics and science fields, but it's not always easy to find them.
Right. And then when you find them, being able to search them. I'd like to look at the possibility of using some people who are interested in using AI to enhance the museum experience.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that within the United States, there should be plenty of those kind of people that are both knowledgeable enough and have interest, but I might be wrong.
Hey. Yeah. So, anyway, Well, thank you.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. I wish you all the best. I hope that you will reach your escape velocity with the Intellis project and that you may see it in good health.
All right, great. Thank you.
NetStack.fm is brought to you by Plavio, building secure, open, and resilient infrastructure with Rust, protocols, and purpose. This show is also made possible by RAMA, the open source networking framework. Plavio offers service contracts and welcome sponsorships to keep building and supporting its ecosystem. The theme music of this podcast was composed by DJ Mailbox. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others discover the show. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time for the next handshake.